Okay, our final argument this morning is ADP LLC versus Nicole Rafferty and ADP LLC versus Christy Mork, numbers 18-1796 and 18-2603. We'll hear first from Mr. Lowe.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Tim Lowe. I represent the appellant in both of these cases, ADP LLC. I would like to reserve five of my 20 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Your Honors, we're here today on ADP's appeal of two motions for preliminary injunction, one in each case. Both Ms. Rafferty and Ms. Mork are former ADP employees who agreed to restrictive covenant agreements by their acceptance of a restricted stock award that they received because of their performance at ADP.
I try to get something off the table. Perhaps you'll disagree, but it's my understanding that in the cases that you've won, because you've had many of these cases, there was a blue penciling out of the restrictive covenant of the prohibition against working for clients for whom the employee had not previously worked or serviced when the employee was at ADP. Is that right?
There have been many different cases. I guess I'll start there with varying.
Yeah, maybe I didn't phrase that question very well. Let me try it this way. Do you agree that we're not supposed to evaluate the enforceability of the restrictive covenant by assuming that the employee is prohibited from working in the same territory as she was previously working for any potential customer?
Well, under the restrictive covenant agreements that both of these defendants agreed to, there's a non-compete provision which would prevent them from working for a competitor in their former territory, which we contend they are both doing. And there's also a non-solicitation provision. And the non-solicitation provision of customers has two components. There's a non-solicitation of current customers and then also of prospective customers. I think all of the courts that have at least enforced the agreement, and I guess when I say it that way, I'm not thinking about the three cases that have been before Judge Kessler, where he simply found the agreements to be restraints of trade. But in the other cases, in the federal cases that where preliminary injunctions were granted, the Manchir case in Tennessee, and then the three cases before Judge Moore in New Jersey, all of those cases have enforced some form of the restrictive covenant related to current clients. None of them have enforced it with respect to all prospective clients, except for those that the defendants learned about or dealt with while they were at ADP. So our position in these cases has been that in these two in particular, when we sought the preliminary injunctions, we were seeking to enforce the non-compete, so keep the defendants from working in their territory, their former territory for ADP, where they are at least in part currently working for Ultimate Software, to enforce the non-solicitation of clients, and that would be any ADP clients, but with respect to the non-solicitation of prospective clients, we are only seeking, because we believe it's a reasonable restriction on the agreement, only seeking to enforce them from contacting prospective clients that they would have dealt with while they were at ADP.
All right. So I think that helps to narrow the issue here. And so I want to focus on the non-compete provision. Okay? New Jersey law says you can't just restrict competition for the sake of restricting competition. It needs to be serving some other goal. Trade secrets, goodwill, relationships, client relationships and things. The problem is that the courts that have ruled against you have, you know, Judge Linares has suggested, well, the other two agreements, the NDA and the SRA, the Sales Representative Non-Disclosure Agreements, already do that. And I might add, well, maybe we could even give you the, you know, if part four of the restricted covenant agreement is valid, the non-solicitation agreement subject to the blue penciling you've bracketed for now, why do you need Paragraph 3, what is the justification for why you need a non-compete on top of all of those things in order to protect trade secrets they already can't disclose, goodwill, and customer relationships that are already protected by saying you can't deal with any of the people you had relationships with before?
Sure. And I think it's looking at varying levels of what the former employee can do with respect to the competition against ADP. So we've got the first agreement that you referenced, the sales representative agreement and the non-disclosure agreement, that would only prohibit them from soliciting clients that they dealt with, and prospective clients that they dealt with. And so that is a base agreement that all salespeople have to sign. As they progress in their careers, they learn about more clients. They learn more confidential information from ADP. They learn how to use it better. That's when they can qualify for the stock awards. And in exchange for receiving the stock award, we have the additional restrictions. The non-compete is important because not only does that prohibit the former employee from soliciting clients of ADP in the territory, but it prohibits them from competing at all in the territory because we think that their own territory, that's where they have the most possibility where they can cause harm to ADP when they go to the competitor. It may not just be with a client of ADP. If they contact a client, for instance, Ms. Rafferty in Boston, if she contacts a client of ADP in Boston, certainly she can put forth all the arguments about why they should leave ADP and go to Ultimate. But if she contacts someone who's not a client, not a prospect that she dealt with in the Boston area, she may have more cachet because she's in Boston. And so that's why that is important.
I don't follow this well enough. If New Jersey cases say the fact that they've got human capital, that they've got experience, et cetera, is not by itself the kind of harm you're allowed to protect against. Competition is not. I don't follow. Is cachet another way of talking about goodwill? In which case, what's the causal link here between having worked for ADP and causing cognizable harm to ADP after they leave that requires the non-compete for 12 months for the whole territory?
Sure. And cachet, I think you're right, is probably not the best word. Goodwill, the relationships that the former employees have developed, not only with customers, but with referral sources. A lot of times these referrals come in through perhaps an accountant or some other type of referral source that can refer a client who needs a payroll provider or a human resources provider. Those relationships are likely stronger in the territory where the employee used to work.
Is that in the category of knowledge, skill, expertise, information that the New Jersey Supreme Court has said in Ingersoll Rand are not legitimately controlled by the former employer through a restrictive covenant agreement?
But these would be relationships that were developed, in this case, while they were employees of ADP. And I think they do have an interest of restricting, obviously, maybe not the general knowledge. You're right. The case law doesn't allow that to be protected. But relationships that they developed on behalf of ADP, they can't then go use
those
relationships.
They can't convert the company goodwill to personal goodwill.
Exactly.
All right. But how does that help you with the geographic prohibition? Because if Rafferty's the one up in New England,
yes,
and Mork's in Chicago. And I mean, if Rafferty wants this prospect in New England and she wants to prospect clients that are not ADP clients, I mean, why should we enforce that? Because there she's not converting her personal goodwill, she's not converting the corporate goodwill that she earned while working for ADP into her own personal goodwill or into Ultimate's goodwill. There, under the hypothetical I pose, all she's doing is using her knowledge, skill, efforts to try to get clients for her new employer.
But she may be competing against ADP in that territory, even if it's not an ADP client. And that's why we then have the non-solicitation restriction that's broader. So the interest that's being protected is different. But in Ms. Rafferty's case, it would only be a portion of her current Ultimate territory where we would say she could not work for Ultimate.
If the interest is simply to prevent competition with your client, aren't we in the territory of illegitimate interest?
But the interest is not to protect competition. It's to protect the client relationships, the referral relationships, the confidential information that these defendants learn about ADP.
Can you explain how that applies in a territorial non-compete? I thought your answer to Judge Hardiman was that by competing in the same territory, even if it had nothing to do with the client, current, former, perspective of ADP, it is offering competition to ADP for the same client, and that is the interest in preventing the employee from competing in that territory.
The interest is protecting the confidential information and the client relationships. There's just different ways of doing it.
Okay. I think that's the line we need to pursue. What are the different ways of doing it, right? Your adversary's best argument is, and Judge Linares, that these other agreements and the other provisions, you can ban solicitation, you can ban using confidential information, trade secrets, all of that is dealt with other agreements. But I'm wondering, how do violations of those provisions come to your attention? How do you know when they're being violated? Are there violations that remain hidden such that nothing short of a prophylactic ban is going to be enforceable here? I'd like to understand your experience. I don't know if you've litigated these cases for ADP across the country, but how typically are you finding out that someone's using a trade secret or using or grabbing a former client or something like that?
Well, I'll answer that by making the first statement that that's why injunctions in these cases are so important. Because a lot of times you don't know. We may find out during the course of litigation that an ADP client in these cases left and went to Ultimate and that the defendant solicited that company. You may on rare occasions find out, and this is in my experience on rare occasions, you may find out from the client when they leave. They may say that they have decided to leave and go to a particular client. A particular competitor of ADP. You may find out just by word on the street via referral sources, but in many instances, it's difficult to find out. And when I said that's why the injunction is so important, it's because that's why the harm here is irreparable.
I don't know. I don't know why you pull the injunction trigger so quickly, sort of presumptively and prophylactically. I mean, I guess that's a business decision your client makes, but why not assume that the people that have taken advantage of these stock benefits actually adhere to the restrictive covenants and trade secret confidentiality and other provisions that you locked them into at the time that you offered them the sweetener?
I want to make sure I understand the question. Why don't we presume that they're adhering to the agreements until we find out that they're not?
Yeah, well, I guess what I'm asking is it the company's practice that as soon as somebody who signs one of the restrictive covenant agreements leaves, that you automatically run to court and try to get an injunction against them even before you have any inkling that they're violating those contracts?
Well, I can speak to my own experience that is not the practice.
Okay.
Once there is a violation, then ADP seeks to enforce that. So in these cases, these in particular, we know that the defendants are working for Ultimate. We know that they're working in the same territory. So that is a violation.
So that's a violation. You just don't know what that means in terms of loss of business, et cetera.
That's right.
Okay. All right.
That's right.
What do we do with the fact that the declaration here, what you put forward and what's in the record as to the interest at stake, say explicitly that it's because of the unique knowledge, skill, and job performance of these employees, which seems to be language that almost verbatim tracks what the Georgia Supreme Court has said are not legitimate interests in Ingersoll Rand?
Well, it's more than that, and I think there's more than that in the declaration that as these employees gain experience, they are going to learn how to sell ADP's products better, and then therefore learn how to sell against the products better. They're going to learn about pricing strategies, product updates, things of that nature that they may be able to use against ADP because they know what's coming down the line when they leave.
But wasn't that exactly the point of the New Jersey Supreme Court, that that becomes part of the employee, that kind of general experience, expertise, knowledge, and if it does not involve proprietary information, a particular trade secret, confidential information, you can't identify that as a legitimate interest to enforce some restriction post-employment.
If we're talking about basic sales training, how to become a salesperson, things of that nature, I think those might fall under the category of general experience that you can't really separate from the person. But when we're talking about how ADP prices its products, that's not something that I think becomes a part of the salesperson that they can just come and or take and use against ADP in the future. That, many cases, I think, would say protect that type of information, a lot of the cases that we've cited in our briefing.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Lowe. We'll hear you on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Schmidt.
Good morning. Excuse me. Good morning, Your Honors. John Schmidt, representing both defendant appellees, Mork and Rafferty. We start with the premise in all of these cases that they are very fact-specific. I have been doing this work for 40 years, and every case is different and has to be looked at specifically with regard to the underlying facts. When you do that and you apply this court's standard of review with regard to preliminary injunctions, particularly the third item that says the ultimate decision to grant or deny the injunction is reviewed with the abuse of discretion standard, I suggest to this court that what Judge Linares and Judge Checkey did clearly overcomes any question of abuse of discretion. ADP is relying particularly on three cases to support its position here before this court that these restrictive covenant agreements, RCAs, have been enforced and that they should therefore be enforced going forward. I submit to this court that there's only one decision that was improvidently decided that has held that. The Mansour decision out of Tennessee never addressed the issue of the restrictive covenant being a restraint of trade. In Jacobs, Judge Linares did not address the decision as to whether the restrictive covenant was a restraint in trade.
All right, so that's really the legal issue we have to decide.
That's correct.
Was it legal error to say that this restrictive covenant agreement is a restraint of trade under New Jersey law?
It was not. It was never addressed in the prior cases. In Lynch-Halpin, Judge Martini addressed it, but he did so by simply paraphrasing Judge Linares and Jacobs.
All right. So the precedent, there's no precedent that binds us. What should persuade us? Talk to us about principle.
What should persuade you is the fact that the New Jersey court is very clear. The Supreme Court has said on multiple occasions, not only in the Solari test, but in Community Hospital versus Moore, that a restrictive covenant should be limited to protect the legitimate business interests of the employer. The covenant should be no broader than is necessary to protect those legitimate interests.
All right, let's start with the easy part, what I think is the easy part. 1 year, that's not too long.
That's not a problem.
Okay. Geographic scope. North America is no good, right? United States is probably no good. But why wouldn't the particular state or city where the worker was located, why wouldn't that be valid?
Generally speaking, geographic scope might be applicable. I suggest that in these two cases, it is not for the following reasons. One, when you look at Rafferty, she was what was considered to be a comprehensive services manager. She was an overlay. She had a territory, but she could not cold call. She could not go out and solicit any clients.
She didn't need to. She had people under her doing it.
She had people who would tell her where to go and what to do. She was selling one specific limited product. If the court were going to, and let's take Rafferty for a second. Mork. Mork was selling to a limited market share of 1,000 employees, I think to 5,000 or 1,000 and above, in the greater Chicago area and several clients in Wisconsin. She didn't have a territory assigned to her. She was given a Salesforce database with specifically identified clients.
And Ultimate, she's of value to Ultimate, and Ultimate wants to poach her because Ultimate wants to get their hooks into those clients in Chicago and Milwaukee, right? And now ADP is saying, look, we're not too happy you left.
Mm-hmm.
You went to our competitor. Good luck to you, but you're because of this agreement you signed for the next year, only the next year, you're not going to be able to work in this business for our competitor in Chicago and Milwaukee. If Ultimate thinks you're really talented and good, they could send you to, they could flip-flop Rafferty and Mork, right? They could send Rafferty to Chicago for a year, send Mork to Boston for a year. Everybody's happy, right? Except Ultimate doesn't get to take advantage of leveraging the relationships that they had when they were working for ADP in those markets.
If she was selling in the same marketplace, doing the same job she did with ADP, either one of these people, I would suggest that Your Honor's correct. But although I'm not sure I agree or disagree with Judge Moore, I think his logic in blue penciling the restrictive covenants to, in fact, make them territorially restrictive to the job and to the market size was probably appropriate under the circumstances. He didn't address the issue. He said, I don't have to address the issue of whether this is a restraint of trade. I can narrow the restrictive covenant properly. And in that case, what he did with the three cases before him, he narrowed the scope of the geographic territory to the market size and client size. So, for instance, with Karamidis, Karamidis had worked for ADP in Georgia. He was selling to a market size of 50 to 150 employees. When he went to Ultimate, he was selling in a market size in Georgia, but the market size was employers who had 200 employees or more. So Judge Moore said, we have to limit the covenant to respect the area that he could compete against ADP in and hurt their clients.
Okay, but
don't you have a problem that the court here didn't make the effort to do that? It took the idea of a non-compete as just a blanket restraint of trade and held the RCA unenforceable without engaging in blue penciling.
He relied on the facts that have come forward since Lynch-Halpin, facts that we have garnered in the 13 other pending, 19 other cases that have been had and discovered to date, to find that the circumstances under which this covenant was required under the incentive stock award effectively fell into the laid law category.
Is that because there were other restraints that came first? In other words, would you agree that this non-compete, a one-year non-compete on their geographic territory, could be applied under New Jersey law to all entering employees? That's a condition of employment for you to start.
That would not protect ADP's legitimate business interests. If you look at, and I think the very, very appropriate language came out of the New York State Court of Appeals in the BDO Seidman case. In that case, the court said that the legitimate interest to be protected was the relationship that the accountant in that case had developed with the clients that he was assigned to work with. Simply saying you can't work in this territory when you're dealing with only a small subset of ADP's 700,000 clients is overbroad. It's not protecting a legitimate business interest.
We are pushing together two discrete arguments. One is narrow and factual, one's broad. The narrow one is the particular things that Mork was doing in this one line of work are not the same as what she's doing somewhere else. That's something the district court ought to address on remand, applying the language of paragraph 3 of the RCA, which talks about what's the same or substantially similar services to competing business as those which I provided to ADP while employed. We don't have a record to go into the kinds of things you want us to do to affirm on that ground. Okay? So you are making a broader argument, which is you can never have a territorial non-compete because it's always sufficient to ban soliciting clients. My concern about that is the one that I raised with your adversary over here, which is, if I'm ADP, how do I know when someone is using trade secrets, confidential information, working with these referral sources, etc.? It's a bit prophylactic, but it's very common, and New Jersey courts have upheld some territorial and temporal restrictions, recognizing that we can't slice this too finely here, because they're never going to find out about a lot of these violations unless you just ban someone from working in the particular market with the particular line of work for a limited period of time, and a year seems reasonable. Now, as to how broad that ought to be geographically, that's probably for the district court on remand.
But what you have here, Your Honor, is a preliminary injunction and an abuse of discretion argument.
If a legal error is abuse of discretion, to Judge Bevis's point, you know, when you're relying on abuse of discretion as appellee, what you're hoping for is factual findings in your favor, because we're not going to reverse those unless they're clearly erroneous. But it's an abuse of discretion to apply the wrong legal standard. And here we don't have facts. What we've got is a contract, and we've got a body of New Jersey state law, and we've got a district court opinion, as I read it anyway, saying this contract's invalid under New Jersey law, I guess under Laidlaw, I guess, is your argument.
He's relying on Laidlaw. He's relying on the Cousins decisions, although they were state court decisions, Cousins and the two subsequent decisions.
And as you said, I think quite wisely and properly informed by your decades of experience in this area, I mean, these things are fact-specific. I mean, you could have two employees in the same department leaving the same employer, going to another place, and a district judge, a good trial judge, will perhaps blue pencil their agreements differently, or perhaps even enforce one and not enforce the other. Is that
and
not
that's
so?
What happened with the cases in the state court. In fact, were concluded. They were on cross motions for summary judgment. We have three pending summary judgment motions before the district courts in New Jersey. Most of these cases had been tried to conclusion before they went to the court for decision. On the preliminary, I apologize.
Yes, okay. Yet you are asking us to affirm, as I understand it, based on not something fact specific, but on a categorical rule that imposing a geographic non-compete is a restraint on trade under New Jersey law.
Not simply geographic restriction. What we have here is we have an RCA agreement that includes both a geographic restriction and a non-solicitation that says you can't solicit any of our 700,000 clients worldwide. When you take the combination of those that these employees were obligated to accept, and you look at the circumstances, and this is important, and this is the distinction, I think, between Linares' decision and Judge Martini's decision, because those facts weren't before the court. But we presented in certifications to the court that these were only presented to the top salespeople, those people who could most compete.
So I've got two problems with your arguments. The first one is I don't think you've responded to whether the narrowly tailored ones work well enough. But second, and this is something Judge Krause was hinting at earlier, you're suggesting that because ADP did more tailoring and it reserved these non-competes for a subset of its people and it was more careful in how it drew these because it layered it on top of non-solicitation agreements, therefore it's invalid. But if they imposed a blanket ban on everybody who came in, then that would be okay, even though that is more restraining of trade. And I'm very concerned about laying out a rule of law that's going to encourage a blunderbuss or shotgun rather than a rifle approach to these agreements.
I'm not suggesting that if these had been required by all people at the time that they first began employment, that they would not have been potential restraints to trade. The facts we have before us, however, is that somewhere between 10 and 50% of the best salespeople were compelled to sign these at the time that they received their incentive stock awards.
They're not compelled to sign them. They choose to sign them.
I apologize, Your Honor. You're absolutely right. These were not obligatory. They had the option to sign them and accept the incentive stock awards. We won't get into the click wrap and the whole area. That's been decided. But
as to that group of employees, I mean, to exceed your sales targets, there are, as I see it, and tell me if I'm wrong, there are two ways you do that. One is that you've touched more ATP clients, so you've got a greater breadth. The other is that you have, with particular ADP clients, you've got more depth. You are very much aligned with that company. You are deep into that company. And in both of those cases, that would seem to present, on the side of goodwill and business relationships, a legitimate interest on ADP's part.
Your Honor said it correctly.
Those employees.
Your Honor said it correctly. And the limiting factor is you touch more clients. We have no issue with a restraint that says you cannot solicit business from clients that you have dealt with or obtained valuable knowledge of while working. They want to impose this so that it's across the board, you can't solicit any ADP clients regardless of whether you have any contact.
In between those two extremes is a middle ground that perhaps the district court will see fit to locate if we remand the case, would it not?
It would depend on the facts of the case and whether or not these people are soliciting clients because of business contacts that they had as a result of information.
And I guess what's a little frustrating about the record, in my view, having done some of these, not nearly as extensively as you have, but having done some of these myself, is, you know, I want to know the details. I want to know exactly who Rafferty, you know, who's her biggest client at ADP, who's she servicing, how did she build her book, how did she climb the ranks, you know.
But you can't do that on a preliminary injunction on papers without some particular factual.
That's
part of the problem.
That's why I'm suggesting that.
But
how can we not remand it?
Was it an abuse of discretion?
Pardon me?
Was it an abuse of discretion when, in the same case involving Judge Martini, this court, and this is what concerns me, Judge, in the Martini decision, this court found that if it was a permanent injunction, the RCA may have been overbroad and we probably would have blue-penciled it or changed it, but it's only for 12 months and therefore we're not going to make an issue of it, because we didn't think there was abuse of discretion. Well, that injunction continues today, almost 3 years.
We're not hearing.
I understand that, but this is, you know, we have the purpose of an abuse of discretion. Judge Lanier is.
So maybe you've just made a compelling argument why this court, to provide some guidance to the district court in New Jersey and the judges on that district court, to implore them to make a fulsome factual record in each one of these cases.
I suggest that that's obviously where we should go, because they are so fact-specific.
Could I ask you to respond to your adversary? I thought one of his cogent points was that the other agreements do not protect against the kind of business that comes out of referral sources.
That's not true. The SRA specifically has a provision.
Could you direct me to it? I have it right in front of me.
I believe, Your Honor, may I pull it?
Sure.
Sure.
apologize, Your Honor. I have everything but the first volume of the appendix with me.
If you can't find it,
thank you.
It's a property opinion.
Okay.
The employee, it's...
What paragraph do you want? JA 42, I guess, the SRA?
I'm looking at the SRA, and I think it's paragraphs... I'm sorry, Your Honor. It talks about, it begins with employees shall not, on employee's behalf or on behalf of any other person.
Was there a number before this?
I think it's paragraph 3, but I'm not absolutely positive, Judge.
Employee will not use or act in any way, directly or indirectly, on any information which became known to employee?
It's paragraph 4A. The employee agrees that during the period commencing the date of the employee, and if you read further on, it talks about located within the territory to sell these. Employee will not disclose to any person any business methods.
Communicate with any person who is a client, bona fide prospective client, or marketing partner.
Marketing partner is the key, Your Honor, because ADP had specific marketing partners that they would have people assigned to work with.
Okay, but let's just back the question up. There might be other referral sources or networks of connections that don't qualify as marketing partners within this. Is that a legitimate interest that would justify additional protection?
Not if this person learned of that on their own accord without any specific input from ADP.
Even if it was on ADP time while they were earning ADP.
It's no different than the skills and knowledge you learn, as far as I'm concerned, the skills and knowledge that you learn in the course of the trade, those are clearly not legitimate interests that can be protected by a restrictive covenant.
I read it differently the way Judge Krause did, which was general skills, general salesmanship, how-to is fine, but this is market-specific, industry-specific connections, and that doesn't look like a generic blunderbuss restraint of trade to me.
I would suggest to Your Honor that if it is a contact that the individual himself developed that has no particular reference to ADP, for which ADP didn't provide information, didn't, in fact, enhance the ability of the person to learn, then that's not a marketing partner. For instance, one of the other cases we had, I think it was La Nobile, he was a CPA concentric sales representative. ADP would have him calling upon CPAs to get referrals for small business, for small businesses. And those CPAs that he learned of as a result of his specific job at ADP, I would suggest, are people who could be restricted. However, if I'm out selling and in my business I simply meet Joe Smith at a Optimist or Rotary meeting and he happens to be a CPA who refers me a client that has nothing to do with my specific referrals from ADP, knowledge I learned specifically from ADP, that is what I consider to be the general skills and knowledge that you learn in the trade and should not be restricted.
That seems to be specific to the industry, to the particular expertise of an employee, to the nature of the market. And here, ADP, in backing off of its insistence on prospective clients, for example, has indicated that it would accede to certain blue penciling. At the end of the day, isn't the issue for us that we, whatever we might think are legitimate interests, we need to anticipate how the New Jersey courts would treat this. And the New Jersey Supreme Court has said in Solari and multiple times since that rather than simply holding a restrictive agreement, a non-compete or a non-solicitation agreement, unenforceable as a categorical matter, that the courts should go forward and engage in blue penciling to make sure that it is reasonable. That's something that could be done on remand, but the district court here took a per se approach that the New Jersey Supreme Court in Solari seems explicitly to say that is not the way we will approach things under New Jersey law.
The court has also said that if the agreement is simply to restrain trade, it should not be enforced. And that's what both Linares, Checkey, Judge McNulty in the district court, Judge Kessler found, that the whole purpose of this was to restrain trade, to keep the best and the brightest salespeople from going out and competing, and that the legitimate interests that ADP had were fully protected by the sales representative agreement that was signed when they came in, that they could not solicit business from any of the clients with whom they dealt. And in fact, in at least one of the cases, the first case that went to decision, the Cousins case, Judge Kessler found that Kessler had violated the terms of the SRA, even though he found that the RCA, the restrictive covenant agreements, were restraints of trade and therefore unenforceable. He did enforce the SRA, and he imposed a limited extension of the restrictive covenant in his Cousins because he had solicited business from clients that he had dealt with. That's a legitimate interest to be protected. To have an agreement such as this, and I think I suggest to the court that on a preliminary injunction, you have to look at the entire document. When you can't solicit any clients across the board anywhere in the world, regardless of whether you had any involvement with them whatsoever, and you can't work in any territory that you may have worked in work, she didn't have a territory, she just had clients assigned, but you can't work in any territory without parsing that somehow, I suggests that it's a restraint of trade.
Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. Mr. Lowe, rebuttal.
Thank you. I'd like to start with the restraint of trade issue that Mr. Schmidt was just discussing. And I think one of the critical issues, and Judge Linares found this in his Rafferty opinion, is he said, and let me start with the test. The test is the Solari test. And we start with first, is there a legitimate interest in the agreement? Judge Linares, in his Rafferty opinion, wrote that there is a legitimate interest in the sales representative agreement and the non-disclosure agreement. And then his concern with the RCA, the restrictive covenant agreement, is that he said the legitimate interest was the same. So he's saying that ADP has a legitimate interest in the RCA, but then he found it to be a restraint of trade.
In essence, it added nothing. It put the employee under additional constraints without getting ADP anything else.
In other words,
was gratuitous. He didn't use that word.
He's ignoring the consideration that the employee got in return for it.
He conceded there was consideration. He's saying that ADP doesn't have a legitimate business interest in the additional constraints, right?
He's looking at whether ADP needs it. And so he's substituting his own judgment for ADP's business judgment, when what he should be doing is looking at, is there a legitimate business interest, which he acknowledged there is, and then look at the undue harm. I think this is what Judge Bevis was getting at. There's two points here. The first, the threshold matter is there a legitimate interest? If there is, then on the next part, the undue harm part, the result is not to say this is a restraint of trade and I'm not going to enforce this at all. It's to blue pencil it as necessary. And all of this really flows out of the application or the misinterpretation of the late law case by Judge Moore in Essex County, where, and we talked about this a bit as well, or Mr. Schmidt did, his concept that these agreements, in order to be enforceable, the RCA must be applied to all employees. But that's not the takeaway from the Laidlaw case. The concern in the Laidlaw case is that there were employees that were being asked to sign non-competes to get stock options who had already been exposed, in some cases, for years to confidential information. And the company in that case didn't put any protections forth at the beginning of employment to protect their confidential information. And that's not what we have here. So all of this, we submit, starts with a misinterpretation of labor law.
But that would seem to be an even stronger case for a legitimate interest in targeting particular employees who were the most involved with a business's clients. If it was not sufficient in labor law, then surely it wouldn't be here.
It wasn't sufficient in labor law because it wasn't protected in labor law. That's the factual difference.
They sought to protect it at a later stage of employment. And with against the default of there being no protection, if there's a legitimate interest at all, it would seem to be a stronger case for that in a labor law situation than here, where there are already layers of protection even before mid-employment, the restrictive covenant agreement is added on.
Right. I think I'm following. Here we have the initial protections, but then as the employees gain additional access to either more clients or larger clients or more knowledge of ADP's confidential information, then when they are provided the additional consideration, offered the additional consideration, in exchange they're asked to sign more restrictive covenants.
I guess my point is that it may be difficult for you to distinguish Laidlaw. It sounds like your argument really is Laidlaw was simply wrongly decided.
I think Laidlaw has been wrongly applied. If we look at Laidlaw as having a very unique set of facts, I think it's just been wrongly applied since then.
What are the key facts that distinguish Laidlaw from this case or that make it not particularly helpful in this case?
Well, the key fact is that there were protections in place from day one on all of ADP's employees. So there is a confidentiality restriction. There is a limited non-solicitation restriction. Those are things that were not in place.
But the RCAs weren't in place.
The RCAs weren't.
But you gave new consideration for the RCAs.
That's correct.
The issue is not whether you have a valid contract within consideration for something that was returned. It's whether it's something that was returned constitutes a legitimate interest under New Jersey law. And there it seems you have a much harder case to make than in Laidlaw because there already are protections in place.
Well, I think that's almost the reverse, though, of how Judge Moore, who is really the judge that has ruled on this issue, has looked at it. I think in his view, it's because not everyone has all of these restrictions, the agreement isn't enforceable. And I think as we briefed and you said, that would be more anti-competitive. If there are additional questions, I'm happy to.
All right. No, thank you, Mr. Lowe. I want to thank Mr. Lowe, Mr. Schmidt, not only for an excellent argument, but for the wonderful display of collegiality regarding the documents. That's always appreciated. And I must say, based on my experience, when you've got round, 15 of 35, that sort of collegiality is not always observed. So the court's particularly grateful for that and commends you for that. We'll take this matter under advisement.